Our next case is Fresh Hub, Inc. versus Amazon.com, Inc. Counselor Andre, you have reserved 3 minutes of rebuttal. This is the third time I see you this week.
We're becoming old friends. Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court, and that's correct, 3 minutes. Your Honor, in order to look at whether or not the District Court should deny FreshHub's JMOL, this Court reviews that under the de novo standard, puts itself in the shoes of the District Court, and tries to determine whether a reasonable jury would come to that conclusion based on the totality of the evidence presented. FreshHub submits that the evidence in this case was overwhelming. We report expert testimony, over 60 exhibits, technical documents, public documents. We put 3 other engineers in our case in chief for deposition.
I'm sorry, I don't see how quantity answers the question of whether on let's just focus on the item point, whether the accused product could, under the claim construction given, basically, is it actually no claim construction? Anyway, not on the specific point in dispute, whether the jury had evidence based on the two sides' testimony on that particular element from which it could decide in Amazon's favor.
Yeah, the only evidence Amazon put forward that was the expert Dr. Johnson, and the Court did not give construction of the term item.
Did you ask for one?
No, the parties put ordinary meaning.
I guess, and we have a rule, like a almost unavoidable rule, that when the parties don't ask for further interpretation of a term, that the jury whether each side's application of that term is reasonable. And why? And tell me if I'm wrong in my understanding. I took it that on this point, Amazon's experts said they interpret this, and it's a reasonable interpretation to mean basically a particular product that is available, not a generic name for a type of product like carrot.
The actual testimony of Amazon's expert was a physical product that you put in a refrigerator, put on a shelf.
Right. I got stuck on that for a while about imagining not just the name for the product carrot as being on the list, but the carrot being on the list so that one would have to say in the vegetable aisle, I wouldn't call that an aisle, I'd call that a list. I don't think that's the list.
But that was the testimony that he gave.
And nobody could possibly understand that.
Well,
you don't put literally carrots and bananas and broccoli on a list. You put them in the cart.
We agree. But that was their position. That's the reason we said there's no support for their expert position. He also said that the word order, when you say Amazon, put milk on my list. That was not an order. That's just an utterance of words. So the two terms that their expert relied on, order and list, were so far removed from an ordinary meaning that the district court erred when it didn't discount that testimony altogether, because that was the only basis for the Amazon's position of non-infringement. In fact, if you look at the actual testimony in cross-examination, we're like, the word milk is an item. According to Amazon, it's on the website, it's on their documents. Dr. Strong, who was the chief engineer of this product, testified milk will be an item. So this is about, it's not a typical battle of the experts, where they had two reasonable interpretations. Dr. Johnson had to go so far afield that it would be impossible, as you said, Your Honor, that his interpretation could not be possibly read into the claim itself.
But the claim says adding or identifying an item corresponding to the text, right? So it couldn't be just a word corresponding to the word. And, corresponding to the text must be doing some work. We must be referring to some kind of object that corresponds to the word for the object. And then that's further bolstered by the way the word item is used in the abstract, and then summary and invention, and then there's other parts of the spec that talk about the SKU identifier for a given object. So, you know, it looks like there's a basis for understanding the word item in the context of this patent that has one of the ordinary meanings of item. I guess item can be defined in different ways, but item can be the actual thing that corresponds to the word for the thing.
Well, I mean, if you go to the, you know, there's two parts of the system here. There's the first system and then the computer system.
Mm-hmm.
And when it talks about receive via the digitizer, a verbal order comprising at least one item. So the order has an item there. So it gives a very limited interpretation. So
there's an orderable item that we're talking about.
Like add milk to the shopping list. Milk would be the item. Now we showed, and everyone admitted, that does go on the shopping list. That item does go on it. And Dr. Strom said that is the item. Their document said that is the item. You have to give such a tortured construction that in order to get away from that, as Dr. Johnson did, in order to you know, find non-infringement. And even the district court in its denial of the JMO recognized that it is the actual physical product on the list, as Judge Tarantino just mentioned, is not, it would not be physically possible. It makes the claim nonsense. So there's absolutely no support, and that's the only evidence they have, that one witness.
But I guess maybe adding an item to the list is the same thing as just reserving the object for purchasing. You know,
well,
and so in that way, you're once again kind of referring to some kind of product that you're adding to your electronic shopping cart.
Yeah, and milk or carrots or it doesn't matter what you put on it. If you used an Amazon product, you have the box sitting in your home. You say, Amazon, Alexa, add Carnation Instant Milk to the shopping list. It will add Carnation Instant Milk. It will identify that. If you say milk, it will just add milk. So it is something that there is no dispute that those items are added to the list. And I don't know how, the only way you can get outside of infringement on the item in particular is make it, as Dr. Johnson did, say it's a physical item. It's something you put in the refrigerator or on the shelf. That's the only way you can get around that term. This was such overwhelming evidence to show that items are added to the list. Even to the point where we had a party admission, the man who designed the product.
I guess if we were to go your way, it seems like the claim would have just said, you know, after converting, you know, to text, just add the text to the list. But the claim actually seems to be calling for something in addition to just merely adding the text to the list. It's identifying an item that corresponds to the text and then adding the item to the list. So it feels like there's something, some more work going on inside this claim than merely adding text, any, you know, verbalized text to a list.
Well, if you read the claim in the totality, when you see the first time the item is used, it's the verbal order comprising at least an item. So you know that the verbal order comprises the item. That's clear. So you're saying something verbally, and that comprises the item. And then you digitize that, and then you add the identify item to the list associated with the user. And then you enable the list, including the identify item, to be displayed to the user. So you have to display the actual item as well on the list that's on a screen. So I don't... Any plain reading, ordinary meaning of the terms... I think you can't get around the claim language and the evidence in this case. A reasonable jury would not have found non-infringement of that element.
And what about there's another element here, right? Memory?
Yeah, it was not argued to the jury, but in closing statements, It was never raised by Dr. Johnson, didn't mention it. Dr. Johnson said the memory's there. It came up in post-trial.
Isn't the dispute about what there is? Whether it's the little device sitting in your home or whether it's that plus back-end systems with which it communicates.
If you look at the claim, it has two systems. And we spent.
I thought that this was a dispute not about the claim so much as what your infringement allegation was or infringement proof was.
The accused products. Yeah. We spent a lot of time talking about that back-end system. In fact, more time on the back-end system than the front-end system. That's objective. There's no possible way you could say we did not accuse that back-end system because that was the evidence we put in. That was part of the trial brief or anything else. That came out of the blue, that we did not accuse the back-end system comprising the servers.
Is there a front-end jury that said otherwise here?
No, it was not. The claim was taken as a whole. But if you look, the evidence that went in was first for the actual Alexa device sitting in your home, and then the back-end system sitting on the cloud or Alexa's Amazon's website. Those were very distinct two systems. And when we spent probably more time talking about the back-end system, and so we accused the back-end system, and we have the evidence, that's objective. And how they came out with how the district court found that it was not accused product is a mystery. I have no idea how that came up. It was not argued to the jury. And just real quick, before I get to my rebuttal time, I do want to talk about the two bases for the new trial. One is the great weight of the evidence.
I'm not actually interested in talking about that, but I am interested in talking about the cross appeal, if this is the right time, or are we going to wait?
Can I do that in rebuttal time?
No, you better bring it up now so that they have the opportunity to respond to that.
But they're the moving party.
Okay. Right. They
can address it.
Okay, so...
On inequitable conduct, and here's my question. In trying to figure out whether there really is only one set of interpretations of what Mr. Weiss and others did here, I would very much like to hear what the non-nefarious scenario is that you think is plausible.
So what happened was there was a change in ownership of the parent company, ICANN, and there was a list of patents that were going to be prosecuted, and those were not. And the principal did not get those emails. Mr. Weiss said, he believed it was transmitted.
Do we have evidence that the principal, is this Mr. Souter or Sauer or something?
Sauer, I believe.
That he did not get the emails?
There's no evidence that he got that.
Okay, well, it's fair enough. I asked you a question about, give me a scenario in which it's possible that these statements were either, that these statements, there's only one statement at issue, was true or at least not intentionally false. So you're describing a scenario.
So a scenario where there was a list of patents that were sent, and there's no evidence Mr. Sauer got those patents. He never expressly said abandon those patents. When he found out,
are you talking about the assignment right now?
This was about a list of patents that were going to be dropped on prosecution. There are already some issued patents on those, and there's some that are going to be pursued.
Okay. You're talking about back during the time where the application, the parent application, received a final office action rejection, and then it was going to go abandoned in 6 months if it hadn't been responded to. Is that the time frame you're talking about?
That's correct.
Okay.
And so there was just no evidence presented, definitely not clear and convincing evidence, that Mr. Sauer saw that information. He expressly said it abandoned. That was his intention. When he found out that it was abandoned, he contacted the attorney because there was a change of ownership and there was a fight. There's lawsuits about ownership of the company. So it kind of went to a black hole. And once they realized they revived it, they revived it. There's nothing nefarious that was going on. And that's what the district, the bench trial is.
So I think I'm not, I think you're sort of halfway to what scenario in which Sauer, was that his name?
I think that he pronounced it.
Sauer, and there was another person that Mr. Weiss said he talked to also, forget his name, but that maybe they didn't get the emails in 2012 or 2011, whichever that was, and what, that it, part of the scenario is that Mr. Weiss would not have followed up on something that I think his deposition has him, in his deposition he said was a pretty big deal and he wouldn't do this without authorization. That's also part of the scenario.
Well, it wasn't expressed, it was, part of the scenario was Mr. Weiss had no recollection and no records whether it was a expressed BAM or not, and there's nothing in the record to show that it was. So it was because of the pending lawsuits and the transfer of ownership of the company and who actually got the information, who obtained the information from Mr. Weiss, there was just no evidence that it was a material misrepresentation. It was clearly no intent. It wasn't even close to getting intent. Mr. Weiss had no intent. Mr. Sauer had no intent. There was nothing.
I remember that Mr. Weiss said the intent that he thought mattered was Mr. Sauer's intent,
his. That's correct.
Right. And that on whether the abandonment was intentional, not whether the by assumption false assertion to the PTO was intentional. Two different intents floating around here.
Correct.
Right. And so you have to have a plausible scenario in which, and you're really focusing on what happened at the company, not what happened at Kenobi. Your scenario is that the emails kind of got lost or something, and that's plausible even though Mr. Weiss would have been pretty careful about allowing this to go abandoned without an authorization.
Well, Mr. Weiss,
I know there's no evidence of the authorization. I'm talking about a scenario that is plausible enough that the district court could say that the evidence that there is leaves a plausible alternative, and as long as there's a plausible alternative, I can and indeed should reject the inequitable conduct.
Correct. And after a thorough bench on this, what the district court found, that was the most reasonable inference, was there was no intent to deceive by the company.
Not quite sure he said that. I think he just said that there's no proof that the most reasonable inference is the bad one. Not that. I don't think he found that the most reasonable inference is the alternative.
Well, there was no intent to see, but I think we're saying the same thing, but maybe just different.
Okay,
but you just keep saying there was no intent. There was no intent, and just to follow up on Judge Toronto's question, it's hard for us to just simply accept the conclusion without understanding what would the scenario have been, the plausible scenario that occurred at the time between the Kenobi attorney and then the client. And how this thing is going to end. And as I understand it, Mr. Weiss said, as a general matter, he wouldn't let something go abandoned unless the client told him it's okay to let this one go abandoned. So then the question is, did that just not happen here? That he didn't ever get the official sign-off from the client to let it go abandoned?
That's what the evidence shows.
Well, I mean, the evidence doesn't show anything, I guess, is the problem here. Maybe that's the problem for the other side. We don't know. Well, I'm just trying to figure out maybe the same thing that Judge Toronto is trying to figure out. Is that plausible that a patent attorney, an experienced patent attorney, would just let something go abandoned if he checks in with the client and the client just is radio silent? And then 6 months elapses, and now the thing is officially abandoned.
I'm not a soothsayer. I can only start with the evidence showed. And so what the evidence showed in this case was that because of the change of ownership in the company, Mr. Sauer being in and being out, and lawsuits being filed. Email went to a black hole, and it was things didn't happen for several years until the company got sorted out. But that's what the evidence is in this case. I'm not trying to guess what really happened because I can only live with the evidence that was presented at trial. And the evidence presented at trial is not clear and convincing. There's absolutely no evidence at all. I think that maybe that's what the panel's having a problem with. There is no evidence at all. And that's more of Amazon's issue than mine. So, thank you.
Good morning. Thank you, the court. Dave Haddon for Amazon. Let me start with the JMAL issue. As the court knows, only in extreme cases can a JMAL be granted for the party that bears the burden of proof. And this is not that extreme case. The claim in this case required translating at least a portion of the digitized order to text and then identifying an item corresponding to the text and then adding that identified item to the list. It's undisputed that in the accused shopping list feature, there is no identification of an item corresponding to the text. The system just adds the word the user said to the list.
Well, this comes down to which ordinary meaning of item is really the right one to go with.
I think it does in a way, in that item has to be a thing that is distinct from the text. But I think that is clear from the language of the claim itself. You have to have text, and then you have to identify an item corresponding to that text.
If the order came in with the text saying, I want, I forget what Mr. Andre's example was, a powdered milk with a, and the person puts in the store SKU number, that would presumably, I mean,
that would be text, right? The examples in this case were, their experts said, add sad to my shopping list. And the word sad shows up in your shopping list. Or you could say, add unicorns, which is what our expert did, and you get the word unicorn.
No, I'm trying to understand so much. So, suppose I typed in or something, or I guess it's not typed in, but gave a verbal order for SKU 12345.
Then SKU 145 would go in, but that would just be text. What it matters is
that would not come under this claim.
It would not because we have not identified an item from the text. That is just random text. It could be anything you said.
It's not random. It's SKU number 12345.
It is, but it's not interpreted as an identification of an item. That SKU number is meaningless in your shopping list. It's just like the word sad or any other word. Now, there are ordering systems that were accused with respect to the other patents where Amazon does try to find a SKU number that corresponds to the words. But that's not what is done in the shopping list. So the step of taking text and then using it to identify a product, which by a SKU number, for example, like you said, which is what the patent describes, is not done. In the patent, you take those words, you try to match them to a description of items in a database. If you find a match, then you find the SKU number corresponding to that item in the database, and that SKU number is the identifier that would get added. None of that happens in the Amazon shopping list because it's not a mechanism for ordering a product at all.
So your evidence about what happens in the accused Amazon system is what?
There was testimony from Mr. Love, who was in charge of that feature, who explained how it worked and how it didn't identify.
How did it work? I want you to describe it.
So all it does is it takes the word that the user says. It stores that word in a database, and it shows that word on the list. There's a completely separate system that is used by other Amazon speechlets that find items when a user says, instead of add to my list, add to my cart. And those features were accused of infringing the other patent in this case that were also found not infringed and from which there is no appeal. So the shopping list feature is completely separate from the ordering features that you can do with Alexa. It's just a way to capture a user's thoughts. The whole purpose is not to order things on Amazon, but just to have a list that you could use anywhere else. So there is no step to match the words in any way to a product you could buy. And there was testimony from Mr. Love, who's in charge of that feature, about that's how it works. And so no contrary testimony.
Right. I assume that when you talk about putting an item on the list, you mean putting a representation in ASCII that corresponds to the physical thing.
We don't mean you put an item on the list. So if you say milk, and if you're going to identify an item, if you say Amazon add milk to my cart, and you have bought Clover 2% milk and a half gallon in the past, Amazon will add that to your cart. But if you say add milk to my shopping list, you just get the word milk, or unicorns, or sad, or anything else. There is no mechanism to try to identify an actual item that you could purchase. That is the distinction. And that goes also with this other point, that there's no digitized order. Right? An order in this patent is not the example counsel used, telling your son to take out the trash. An order is a purchase request. If you look at figure 8, which is the only figure in this patent that describes this voice shopping idea at all, the last step is place order. So when we're talking about order, we're talking about a purchase request, an order for an item. But there is no order that is received when someone says, add something to my list. It's not a mechanism for ordering a product at all.
Can you comment on the second issue about
the memory?
The memory.
Yeah. This claim requires two computer systems, right? And FreshHub made the strategic choice to accuse only the user device, the Echo, the Fire TV, or the Fire tablet. And they did that because nobody uses their Fire TV to order products or add to their shopping list, right? So they would have a tough time showing damages. But by accusing the product...
At trial, didn't the back-end servers come up quite a bit?
The back-end servers, they talked about them, but what the jury was instructed and what was in the final pretrial order was that the accused products were the user devices, the Echo, Fire tablet, or the Fire TV. And of course, those do not include the components on the back-end server.
Did they refer to Alexa?
They accused those products. Those products can interact with Alexa, but what was accused was the end-user products that interact with Alexa. So those products obviously do not include the servers, and our expert explained that, and their expert admitted on cross that they don't include the servers and the non-volatile memories on the servers. So those products themselves do not literally infringe.
Why didn't you raise this at trial?
We did. He's wrong. It's in our brief. Our experts said it. Their experts said it on cross. That's why Judge Albright addressed it in the JMOL. There was evidence at trial completely about this.
So what I'm sitting here thinking is, I guess I'm thinking, I'm not sure whether the argument here is about insufficiency of evidence, or it's about the plaintiff, are bound to something in a pretrial instruction that you didn't object to, or bound to something in the pretrial order.
I think they were bound to what was in the pretrial order as to what the accused product was, and because that was also what the jury was instructed the accused product was. They can argue about other things, but what they had to show at trial was the accused product they identified in the final pretrial order and that was identified to the jury. That had to meet the elements of the claim, and it didn't. So there are three major issues where they didn't meet their burden, and we're nowhere near the type of extreme case where JMOL is appropriate, particularly in the Fifth Circuit, where, as you know, the jury was free to disregard their expert entirely, so they would have no evidence of infringement, and that was within the jury's purview.
Let me switch, unless you would like me to address the new trial issues, which you didn't hear about, I'm fine skipping that. Let me go to the inequitable conduct, because there are a few things that were said here that were flat out wrong. So Mr. Weiss testified that he received the final rejection. That is something he would forward to his client. Now, they withheld those communications as privilege.
But we don't have an
objection. But we do have a privilege log.
Right, but we don't have an objection from you on appeal about the claims of privilege.
No, you're correct, Your Honor. Correct. And so all I was going to point out is that there are communications in the privilege log from Mr. Weiss to Fresh Hub right after that he received that final rejection, and he testified he had no reason to believe that the client did not receive that communication, and it was his practice was to send it. Same thing with the notice of abandonment. There's a privilege.
Just to clarify, I don't quite remember the items in the privilege log about communications with, I guess ICANN it was, or ICANN.
Yes.
Were about communications that came after the email he sent?
Yes. Okay. So there, these communications are limited to this application because that's the only thing right. They logged.
No, I'm asking a question about the precise timing.
Oh, yeah, I can give you the timing. I have it here written down. So after the final rejection issued, there's a log entries 91 and 92 that were sent 2 weeks later, the same month. Those are 17, 20 to 21 of the appendix. After the notice of abandonment issue, there are log entries 98 and 99, dated 3 days after the receipt of that abandonment. Those are 17021. And then there are communications to Mr. Weiss before the petition to revive in 2017, and those are at 17024. Now,
how do we know these communications that occurred are necessarily about this particular application?
Because Mr. Weiss testified that he only logged communications that referred to the patents in suit. And this is the only pending application that related to these patents. All of these patents were filed based on the revived application that we're talking about now. So these are only about that application. That's the only thing he logged. That's the only thing he provided to us.
And am I understanding the inference that you're asking from that is that the...
Mr. Weiss followed his practice and communicated this.
That non-receipt, the emails falling into a black hole is disproved by this.
That didn't happen.
It's not
possible. And more importantly, we know it didn't happen because in December 2012, Mr. Weiss prepared this assignment document that explicitly listed this application as abandoned.
Well, not so... clearly abandoned.
Well, Mr. Weiss admitted that he listed it as abandoned.
Well, on the assignment, it says something like abandoned, expired, or something else.
Or inactive. But Mr. Weiss testified.
And so, therefore, if you're just looking at the face of the assignment, which has assorted application numbers, patent numbers, some of which have this label of, you know, that it's not clear just from the face what that this thing was abandoned, this particular application was abandoned.
Understood, but Mr. Weiss testified that he listed it and knew it was abandoned when he included it on that assignment document.
He knew, but that doesn't necessarily mean the client knew.
Understood, but the client received that and signed it in front of a notary. So this black hole notion is wrong. The client received it and signed it in front of a notary. Now, let me switch a little bit, because under FMC and other cases, right, Mr. Weiss's intent is attributable to the client. So regardless, if we look at what Mr. Weiss knew, Mr. Weiss testified that he knew that this abandonment was not a mistake. He knew it was intentional. I asked him, and he testified. In 2017, did you wake up and you didn't wake up and find out this was a mistake? And he said, correct. So Mr. Weiss knew this abandonment was intentional. He also testified that he
knew. Well, I think there's knowledge of it being abandoned, and there's knowledge of it that the client intended it to be abandoned are two different things. They're closely related, but they're different enough that that difference matters to this case.
I understood, but I think the point is when Mr. Weiss filed the petition to revive, right, the Patent Office said this has been abandoned a long time. We're relying on you that entire delay was intentional.
Unintentional.
Now, when Mr. Weiss knew in 2012 that the patent was abandoned, and he testified he did nothing to revive it, he testified he knew in 2013 that the patent was abandoned, and he did nothing to revive it. He knew in 2014 it was abandoned and did nothing to revive it. He knew in 2015 it was abandoned and did nothing to revive it. And he knew in 2017 that it hadn't been a mistake on his part. How can he truthfully say that entire delay was unintentional? Right? If you know something is abandoned.
On that particular question, I thought he was explicit that he said that he thought the intent for abandonment was not his, but the client's. And he did not know that, or rather, his knowing that it was abandoned is not the same thing as the client having intentionally done so.
But his intent goes to the client under FMC. He knew in that entire period that the patent was abandoned.
Does FMC say that when an attorney knows that an application goes abandoned, that necessarily translates to the client knowing and intentionally choosing to deliberately allow an application to go abandoned? Is that what FMC says?
It doesn't matter whether...
Is that what FMC says?
FMC says that the intent of...
Yes or no, is that what FMC says?
I don't know if FMC says explicitly that. What FMC says is that the intent of the applicant's representative matters.
Right, one of the things I said to Mr. Andre is there are two intents floating around here. I think you're talking about the second one.
I'm talking about
the intent behind the representation to the
exactly,
PTO,
Your Honor.
Not the intent
exactly,
to,
Your Honor.
For the abandonment.
Exactly, Your Honor. So when he says that this entire delay was unintentional, that is not correct. He knew it was abandoned. He did nothing to revive it. So therefore, whatever that period of delay between 2012 and 2017, it couldn't have been a mistake. He knew it wasn't a mistake. He knew every year it was abandoned, and he did nothing to revive it. That is an intentional act.
Okay.
Thank you.
I'm going to ask that you restrict your comments regarding the cross appeal to his arguments.
Okay, and just very clear, counsel said I was mistaken that we didn't accuse the Alexa system. That's not correct. It was in the pretrial order. We always put in the fact that we accused the products they sell, which is Amazon Echo, the Fire TV. We always say that the products always have. We include Alexa. And in our pre-trial, we talk Alexa system. It has to connect with Alexa system. That's the second end of it. So when we talk in our pre-trial, this is at 16349350, that the Amazon Echo products include all these different products, and they say they also include Alexa. So I think that's undisputed. With respect to the cross-appeal issue, very briefly, There is a two-step issue. There is the
the falsity question and then
intent.
Intent. But the falsity includes a different intent. The falsity includes, since the statement that is supposedly false was a statement about the client's intentional abandonment, and I think as I'm understanding things, the core of your point is that it was not proved by clear and convincing evidence that the client intended the abandonment.
That's correct. And nothing in the evidence shows that the patent examiner operated in bad faith. I would like to talk about the new trial, but we didn't talk about it, so I will respect the court and not bring that up. But hopefully it's down in the papers.
Thank you.